Hello, I'm Lynn Ahmoudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will look at breast cancer. 2.3 million women were diagnosed with breast cancer globally in 2020, and 685,000 people died of the disease. That's according to the World Health Organization. More than 60% of the mortality occur in developing countries, where the majority of cases are diagnosed in late stages. Breast cancer can also affect men, but is less common. We start with the story of Malet Girma, an Ethiopian-born California girl who found out she had breast cancer in 2017. She had been outspoken about her condition, treatment, loss of hair, support group, and her spiritual life by vlogging her journey, video blogging. Although Malet recently lost the battle to cancer weeks ago, her vlogs have created awareness. VOA's Eden Guillermo has the story.
As you see this, probably, you know, the ending will probably end what happened. And I'm not, you know, recording this so you guys can, or anything like that. I am recording so you guys are encouraged by the journey. No matter what we go through.
This was the final message the 46-year-old Mahalet Girma sent via YouTube for her followers. It has been viewed over 500,000 times. Mahalet has been vlogging for over 4 years about her breast cancer diagnosis and treatment. Born in Ethiopia and raised in California, Mahalet came from a family of cancer fighters and survivors like her mother.
When I was pregnant with her, there was a lump in my breast, and then I had to get it out. Then, you know, after that, I had some lumpy breasts and I had biopsies which were all negative, till I found that in 2015.
The first time Mahalet found a lump in her breast and removed was when she was 17 years old. Fortunately, that lump wasn't cancerous. Since then, she and her mother had removed several lumps, prompting a request for genetic testing, and the result shows that the mother and daughter are genetically predisposed. A year later, Mahalet found out she had a breast cancer, but instead of a silent fight against the disease, she started vlogging her journey in order to create awareness about breast cancer and the treatment.
What she did with the vloggers, she wanted everything open to everyone, so that when they pass through things, so they know what to ask, what next, and things like that. And they should learn about cancer and the treatments openly. And that you can be strong mentally and you can win this. So that's what her motto was.
Cancer survivor Mulu Burhan Girma says support plays a big role during the journey.
A strong support group is very, very important. And they have to be, as I said, they have to be a really good support group. They don't have to sympathize or empathize or something. So it's better, like her friends, I remember, they will be just coming one by one every time she goes to chemo. And they bring something that she likes, and that's acceptable also.
Mahalet Girma passed away on September 7, 2021. On her last video, she recorded a message for her followers saying her journey doesn't define theirs and encouraged people battling cancer and any other challenges to stay strong.
That was the story of Mahalet Girma. Now, for more on breast cancer, I spoke to Dr. Mokhtar Touré, full professor of medical oncology at the University Félix Houphouët-Boigny Training and Research Unit in Medical Sciences, University Hospital of Trècheville in Abidjan. He elaborates on breast cancer in African women.
Cancer is the disease of the cell. The mother cell can be affected by different risk factors that will attack the main characteristics of the cell, deregulates it, and makes it more immortal. As the cell becomes immortal, it spreads, destroying surrounding tissues progressively and creates metastasis, the severe form of cancer. There are factors that create hormonal imbalance in the body. Other factors that can cause hormonal imbalance are early puberty, before the age of 9, late menopause, after 55, and the first full-term pregnancy, over 35 years. Additionally, there is obesity and a sedentary lifestyle. Tobacco is also recognized today as a risk factor. All these factors mentioned are in about 95% of cases. The other 5% are hereditary. When you have a first-degree relative like a mother or a sister who has breast cancer, your risk is multiplied by 3. In our medical practice, daily we see black African women with breast cancer who have had puberty at 12, menopause at 50, and given birth from the age of 18. These are risk factors that are not typical ones as described in medical literature. So, there are risk factors specific to the black African woman that need to be analyzed in prospective study. In recent months, there has been a rising incidence of breast cancer among young women between the age of 35 and 50. What we see is that about 40 and 50% of these women have nicotine poisoning, and tobacco could play an important role. When a woman comes to see us with a lump or nodule in the breast, it could be a telltale sign. We can suspect breast cancer also in a woman with leaking blood in the nipple, a deformation of the breast, asymmetry or breasts that are uneven, and a wound at the breast that does not heal. The person may have nothing during systematic screenings. Mammography makes it possible to suspect breast cancer. A woman might have pain in the bones. In this case, the goal is to manage it and make her comfortable. So each step has a treatment strategy. Cancer treatment is complex. There is the patient's psychological care, sharing the diagnosis, talk to the patient, talk to the parents. It's a holistic care. So in the addition to technical care, there's a psychological care. So we bring psychologists into the treatment strategy, even spiritual and supportive care, managing pain, bone pain, psychological pain. The main prognostic factor in cancer in sub-Saharan Africa depends on poverty. Ways to lower the impact of breast cancer includes to love people, reach out and show empathy, avoid stress, do a lot of sport, eat less fat, consume fibers and vitamin-rich food, avoid animal protein as much as possible, go to the gym, laugh a lot, and avoid oxidative stress. And finally, avoid smoking.
That was Dr. Mokhtar Touré, professor of medical oncology at the University Félix Houphouët-Boigny in Abidjan. Now to Cameroon, where the neonatal mortality rate has reached 28 deaths per 1,000 births, according to official statistics. To overcome this problem, a team of engineers has developed for 3 years an interactive incubator that allows parents and doctors to constantly monitor the health of premature newborns. Thierry Kaori has the details.
In this hospital, premature babies, sometimes weighing less than 2 kilograms, are placed in incubators that are made in Cameroon. Equipped with cameras, these incubators transmit in real time all the vital signs of premature babies to health personnel and parents. They use rechargeable solar batteries, making it possible to cope with frequent power outages.
This incubator has various benefits because we can monitor the babies from a distance. With the prevention of infections and the coming and going of people in the room, since the mother doesn't always have access to the room, being at home or outside, she can monitor her baby and the movements of her baby.
After about 2 weeks in this hospital, Isabel Toumi's premature baby is already doing better.
When I gave birth, he weighed less than 2 kilos. I was referred to this place, and now he's already at a healthy weight. The color of his skin improved too. He is more of a healthy pink color, and he's crying normally. For me, it has been beneficial.
The University Agency for Innovation, at the origin of this initiative, has already sold 18 incubators to public and private hospitals in the country. The cost is about 2 million CFA francs per unit, so buyers have the option of paying in installments.
First, it works like a normal incubator, meaning premature babies are in a soundproof space. There are ideal thermal conditions for the baby's development, and it's all done through electrical regulation. In our particular context, in addition to the global context, and this particular resilience to energy issues, we wanted to ensure an interactivity and allow monitoring from a distance, as well as close monitoring.
The University Agency for Innovation says it's working with the Cameroon's health ministry to equip hospitals with 1,000 incubators over the next 4 years.
Experts say bone marrow registries have few black donors anywhere in the world and are non-existent in many African countries. It is a real problem that impacts the African diaspora in France, since the ethnic origin of donors and recipients must be as close as possible. We caught up with Corinne Tonnier, who is leading the fight in France to convince Afro communities to mobilize and become donors. This is a report by Elam Lecoeur in Paris.
Corinne Tonnier is a mother who lost her 13-year-old son, Ulysse, to a rare blood disease 9 years ago. His only hope for a cure was a bone marrow transplant. But with so few members of France's African diaspora registering as donors, no compatible match was found. So Tonnier created an organization in Ulysse's memory and organized this football match in a Paris suburb in September to raise awareness of France's need for more ethnic African donors.
I have a second son who also has a rare blood disease that will require a bone marrow transplant. For now, he's trying to hold on. Unfortunately, today, there is no suitable donor in the registry for him.
The French government's biomedicine agency says African origin donors are underrepresented not only in the French registry, but in all global registries. Only two African countries have bone marrow donor registries accredited by the World Donor Marrow Association, Nigeria and South Africa. Experts say it is especially hard for Black patients to find compatible donors of African origin because Africans have a greater genetic diversity than other groups like Caucasians. Françoise Audat, a French doctor specializing in blood disorders, is helping Tonnier to highlight these issues.
We try to register African donors all over the world, but the proportion of Africans in some countries is not very high, so it takes a lot of volunteers to find a compatible donor. One could imagine having registries in Africa with more donors to provide bone marrow to compatriots in diaspora communities around the world. But the problem is political instability, which makes communication difficult.
Without more African donors, a patient has only a small chance of finding a match. The French Biomedicine Agency says the likelihood of any individual patient being compatible with a bone marrow donor chosen randomly from the world's registries is just 1 in 1 million. For Elam Lecoeur in Paris, Michael Lippin, VOA News.
You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It is time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Stay informed and up to date Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC with VOA's International Edition. Our correspondents bring you the news from around the globe, plus we delve into the context of the day's biggest stories with interviews with experts that place the story into context to understand why it matters. VOA's International Edition, your best source for news and information.
Welcome back to Health Chat. Uganda has begun a clinical trial for the HIV injectable drug cabotegravir. Uganda is one of three countries in Africa, including Kenya and South Africa, that got approval from the World Health Organization to carry out the trials. By Alima Atumani in Kampala, let's listen up on what is happening on the ground.
Uganda has kick-started a trial for the injectable HIV drugs cabotegravir and rilpivirine. Researchers and those living with HIV say the trial will likely end pill fatigue, fight stigma, improve adherence, and ensure parents get the right dosage. Halima Athmani reports from Kampala. Cabotegravir and rilpivirine have been in use as tablets. The World Health Organization last year licensed their use as injectables. While the two injectables already went through trials in Europe and North America, this will be the first time they are tested in an African population for efficacy and safety in an African healthcare system. Uganda is one of three African countries, along with Kenya and South Africa, which got approval from the WHO to carry out the trials. However, Kenya and South Africa have yet to acquire approvals to start their trials, expected by the end of the year. Uganda and Kenya will both have three trial sites, and there will be two in South Africa, with a total of 512 participants, 202 from Uganda, 160 from Kenya, and 150 from South Africa. Dr. Ivan Mambly, the lead project researcher at the Joint Clinical Research Center, says participants will need one injection every 2 months.
We're going to choose participants who are already on ART and are stable on ART, and we will randomize them to either continue on their normal treatment, which is the pills that they've been taking, or to switch them to these injectables. The injection is on the buttock.
Uganda has 1.4 million people living with HIV/AIDS. Barbara Kemigisa, who is living with HIV and founded the Pill Power Foundation working with rural women, says the injectable drugs will increase adherence to treatment and ensure people get the right dosage.
One of the things that affects adherence is the fact that people have to hide medicine. In the village, people are hiding medicine in the kitchen roof, in trees, in bushes, in a baby's shoe, you know. If someone is wrapping the medicine in like 5 plastic bags and digs a hole in the garden and keeps the medicine there, by the time someone is taking that medicine, it's no longer medicine but poison.
Nicholas Niwagawa, who has worked with young people living with HIV, welcomes the trial, saying it will reduce the pill burden and fight stigma.
Young people feel like this is a lot of pills to take. Those who are on the first line, they will have to take one tablet a day. They're also on second line, and they have to take more than one pill, and they have to take it in the morning and in the evening. And of course, this requires you to have actually a balanced diet, which is really a challenge for most of young people, especially those from vulnerable communities.
According to the WHO, there are 25.7 million people living with HIV in Africa. With only the pill currently available to manage the scourge, this injectable may come as a relief for people living with HIV/AIDS. Halima Othmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
South Africa has declined to approve Russia's COVID-19 Sputnik vaccine for use in the country. The South African Health Products Regulatory Authority, SAHPRA, says it has concerns about its safety in populations at risk of HIV infection. South Africa has the highest burden of HIV in the world, with almost 8 million people out of a population of 16 million living with it. It also has the highest HIV infection and prevalence rates. Darren Taylor reports.
The Russian jabs being used by more than 70, mostly developing nations, even though it's yet to be approved for emergency use by the World Health Organization. Evidence from Russia and other countries suggests it's safe and effective at preventing serious COVID-19, but the vaccine remains controversial. Some of the world's top scientists question whether Sputnik's been assessed properly for rare side effects. Russian President Vladimir Putin also didn't exactly inspire confidence in the vaccine when he announced its registration before trial results were available.
The concern is about the vector that's used. So the adenovirus, the common cold virus that's used as the vector for this vaccine.
Dr. Richard Lessels is an infectious diseases expert who advises the South African government on strategies to combat COVID-19.
The concern is based on results from previous studies of an investigational HIV vaccine that showed that in people given the vaccine, in men given the vaccine, there was an increased risk of acquiring HIV, so being infected with HIV, as opposed to a decreased risk, which they were hoping for with the vaccine. And it was seen particularly in men that weren't circumcised and men that had antibodies to that adenovirus, to that common cold virus.
Confidentially, South African Health Department officials have told VOA the Russian application for approval of Sputnik in the country was totally incomplete. Lessel says he's also heard this.
What I understand here is that the company haven't been able to kind of give sufficient safety data that really pertains to that risk, that reassures that that risk does not exist.
He says he understands that it would have been extremely challenging for the Russian scientists to provide specific data pertaining to South Africa with its massive HIV-infected population. But he argues that the manufacturers should have done something along these lines if they wanted Sputnik to be approved in the country.
The first step might have been to do animal studies, to do studies where you give the vaccine to animals and then expose them to an HIV-like virus and see whether it increased the risk of HIV infection in those animals. Clearly, the data in humans is much more difficult. We could ask for safety data from the trials and from places where the Sputnik has been rolled out, but that requires really close monitoring of people, and to do HIV testing for large numbers of people in a mass rollout of a vaccine is complicated.
Some South African political parties claim there's discrimination against vaccines produced in countries outside the West, specifically Russia and China.
I mean, I'm aware of these arguments, but I don't follow the logic, really. And I think here you're seeing a very specific issue that's been raised and where data has been requested on this specific issue. And as Sapra say, they haven't been provided with that data.
South Africa's medicine regulators are respected internationally for their skill and rigor. However, the same can't be said for most of the rest of Africa, where in some cases there aren't drug approval bodies. The South African rejection of Sputnik raises serious questions about the vaccine's use in many countries on the continent, some of which also have large numbers of HIV-infected people. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Authors of a new report on Africa's climate warn the continent is heating up more and faster than other regions in the world. And they say Africa needs immediate financial and technological assistance to adapt to the warming environment. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The African continent constitutes 17% of the global population, but is responsible for less than 4% of greenhouse gas emissions, which are leading to climate change. The report finds changing precipitation patterns, rising temperatures, and extreme weather triggered by climate change are happening globally, but notes these events are occurring with greater frequency and intensity in Africa. Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Petteri Talas, says there were 700 major disasters on the continent last year. He says more than half have been flooding events and one-sixth have been storming and drought events, respectively.
We have seen almost 100 million people who have suffered of food insecurity, and they needed humanitarian assistance and the combined effects of conflicts, climate hazards, and especially this COVID-19, they have been contributing to the increase of 40% of food insecurity.
This multi-agency report entitled State of the Climate in Africa 2020 was coordinated by the World Meteorological Organization with the help of the African Union Commission and various UN agencies. The report finds the warming trend over the last three decades in all African subregions was stronger than in the previous 30 years. During this period, it says Africa has warmed faster than the global average temperature over land and ocean combined. It says higher than normal precipitation and flooding predominated in places such as the Sahel, the Rift Valley, and the Kalahari Basin. At the same time, dry conditions prevailed in the northern coast of the Gulf of Guinea and other locations, while drought in Madagascar triggered a humanitarian crisis. Tala says sea level rise is threatening many coastal cities in Africa like Lagos, Nigeria's economic hub and a major financial center in Africa. He says climate change also is having a devastating impact on the last remaining glaciers in East Africa.
Three African glaciers, Mount Kenya, Rwenzori and Kilimanjaro, and you can see that there has been major loss of the sea ice area and also sea ice mass, and if the current trends continue, we won't see any glaciers in Africa in 2040s.
The African Union Commission reports adaptation costs in sub-Saharan Africa are estimated at $30 billion to $50 billion, equivalent to 2 to 3% of regional gross domestic product each year over the next decade. However, it notes the cost of doing nothing will be much higher. By 2030, it says up to 118 million extremely poor people will be subject to devastating impacts of drought and intense heat. It adds subsequent displacement and migration consequently will lead to a further 3% decrease in GDP by 2050. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now, New Energy Nexus Uganda is an initiative of a U.S.-based international nonprofit with programs in East Africa and around the world. Its Ugandan initiative provides low-cost clean energy loans to empower rural community-based organizations and receive financing to launch sustainable clean energy enterprises. Aneri Pradhan is a board director of New Energy Nexus Uganda. VOA's Ruben Kiama spoke to her about what her organization is doing.
New Energy Nexus is a global organization that funds and supports clean energy accelerators all over the world. And New Energy Nexus Uganda is focused on the clean energy access ecosystem in Uganda. Our approach is to support community-based organizations working in the last mile with access to financing and support to create their own clean energy businesses that so they can distribute products to people in their communities as a social businesses. So New Energy Nexus Uganda to date has funded 120 community-based organizations across Uganda and has provided energy access to over 100,000 people living in the last mile through cook stoves and solar products and water filtration products. Our mission is to improve lives in the last mile through access to these types of technologies. Our hope is to move across borders and work with community-based organizations in other countries in Africa to empower local communities to do the same.
Your organization has been named among the finalists for the Ashden Awards given to low carbon pioneers globally. What does such a global recognition mean to you and to other organizations working in Africa?
The Ashden Awards means a lot for us to be recognized on such a global stage and for work that we do locally, because our work is so driven in the communities we work in and are locally based and sourced and supported, and just to really elevate the importance of community-based organizations in the work that we do. And so by recognizing New Energy Nexus Uganda, it's also a recognition of the importance of community-based organizations. And so for that, that's really, really meaningful.
What are some of the key actions that communities and nations, especially in Africa, can take to reduce the threat from climate change?
There are hundreds of thousands of these organizations across Africa who are really started by local community leaders and work directly with the community. And so they are best set up to not only innovate and come up with solutions to support the communities, but to also come to implement climate resilience projects. So what I would really urge is for especially international nonprofits, groups or donors to really look at these local community-based organizations for really delivering the climate change actions that we want to see in the continent, and make sure that the decision makers and the people that are empowered by this work is all done through local leadership.
What is your message or what is your appeal to world leaders and the international community as we gear up to the UN Climate Change Summit in Glasgow later this month?
My message is there's a lot of innovation in the Global South, a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of thought leaders, a lot of experts, and for them to play a decision-making role in these COP26 processes and negotiations, that there is room and ability for a lot of the negotiating strength to come from people like this. And so it's not, you know, just the Europe and the U.S. who's driving all the conversation. It's really important to be incredibly inclusive.
That's all for this edition of Health Chat. For the latest news and coverage on the coronavirus pandemic, visit voanews.com. Check us out at facebook.com/voahealthchat and let's keep the conversation going. Thank you all for joining us, and special thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Ahmudu in Washington, with producer Dan Brown. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and wash your hands more frequently, and strive to make every day a healthy day.